KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Europeans are stunned at being sidelined from U.S.-Russian negotiations on Ukraine. A handful of the continent's leaders are meeting in Paris to discuss a security future without the U.S. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Since President Trump installed himself as chairman of the Kennedy Center, several arts and culture leaders have cut ties or canceled shows. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We talked to comedian activist W. Kamau Bell about his decision to go ahead with his performance last week. Also, a second city in the Democratic Republic of Congo falls to Rwandan-backed rebels. And we hear about a woman who has been living in a church sanctuary in Denver for 3 years. It's Monday, February 17th. Actor, director, and producer Joseph Gordon-Levitt turns 44 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russia says top officials are going to Saudi Arabia today. The Kremlin says the Russian officials will meet with U.S. counterparts and talk about the war in Ukraine. NPR's Aya Batraoui says Secretary of State Marco Rubio has arrived in Saudi Arabia.
Rubio's leading a team of White House officials today to Saudi Arabia, where he will meet with Kremlin officials during their time there to discuss ending the war in Ukraine. Now, these talks are ahead of what could be a Trump-Putin summit in Saudi Arabia. Ukraine says they're not part of the talks today, but Ukraine's president is in the UAE right now, and he's expected to head next to Saudi Arabia.
NPR's Aya Batraoui reporting. European leaders have been left out of the talks in Saudi Arabia. They're having their own meeting today in Paris. They fear the U.S. will try to push Ukraine into taking a bad peace deal with Russia. Yesterday, President Trump said Ukraine's president would be involved in negotiations, but he did not elaborate. The nation's governors are gathering in Washington this week. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports this comes as several states have sued the Trump administration over its efforts to reshape the federal government and workforce.
Thousands of government employees, including probationary workers or recent hires, are getting laid off as billionaire Elon Musk tries to cut government spending with his unit, the Department of Government Efficiency. Speaking alongside Musk, President Trump says DOGE has found billions of dollars in waste and fraud, but didn't provide evidence for where those numbers are coming from. The website for DOGE says receipts for, quote, savings are coming over the weekend, but haven't been posted. 14 states sued Trump and Musk for Musk's, quote, unchecked power over the government and its workforce. The White House, for its part, says that Musk is complying with federal laws. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
Meanwhile, some federal workers getting layoff notices are staffers at the Federal Aviation Administration. A union leader who represents some FAA workers says hundreds of probationary employees have been fired at an agency that is already short on air traffic controllers. There have been concerns about short staffing at the FAA after last month's deadly air crash in Washington that killed 67 people. The stock market is closed today for the President's Day holiday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Asian stocks were mixed overnight.
Japan's Nikkei average rose slightly after news Japan's economy grew somewhat faster than expected in the final months of last year. Stocks were also higher in South Korea, while indexes fell in both Hong Kong and Shanghai. Investors in the U.S. will get some updates this week on the health of the housing market. The Commerce Department reports Wednesday on new home construction. That'll be followed on Friday by a realtor's report on sales of existing homes. High prices and high mortgage rates have been a drag on the housing market, which has knock-on effects for appliance and furniture sales. Mortgage rates dipped a little bit last week, but are still hovering just under 6.9%.
NPR's Scott Horsley. It's NPR. Opposition lawmakers in Argentina are threatening to impeach the country's president over his endorsement of what appears to have been a cryptocurrency scam. As NPR's Kerry Kahn reports, the far-right libertarian leader promoted a crypto coin and then withdrew his backing hours after it was launched.
Friday night, President Javier Milei posted on X an endorsement of a new crypto coin called Libra. The currency launched just hours before the president's post promised to strengthen the Argentine economy. Under an hour of Milei's promotion, the coin rose to nearly $5 in value. However, soon it plunged to under a dollar. Saturday, Millet deleted the tweet, denied relation to the coin, and blamed critics for attacking him. Observers say the coin launch is a so-called rug pull, where developers attract investors, then bolt. Millet's crypto move echoes similar steps by President Trump, a close ally. Days before his inauguration, Trump released a namesake coin, which has since plummeted in value. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
Potent storms in the south over the weekend have killed at least 10 people. One person perished in Georgia. 9 people died in Kentucky, where flash flooding has led to more than 1,000 water rescues. Kentucky's governor says the entire state is affected. The National Weather Service has posted extreme cold warnings for much of the Central Plains this morning. Temperatures are well below zero from Montana to Michigan. Wind chill readings make it feel much colder than that, as far south as Oklahoma. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, Christie's Auction House is pushing ahead with a controversial auction of art made by artificial intelligence. But first,
as high-level American and Russian delegations are expected to gather in Saudi Arabia in the coming days to begin negotiations to end the war in Ukraine, European leaders are meeting in Paris today after being cut out of those negotiations.
After Trump officials traveled to Europe last week, it became clear the post-war security order in Europe that's been in place 80 years is no more.
We go now to NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris to hear more about this. So, Eleanor, why has this shook up Europe?
Well, you know, Europeans knew the Trump administration was going to be a rougher ride than the Biden administration, but they still held out hope that the U.S. and Europe could work together, especially on ending the war in Ukraine. But that illusion burst this week. First, there was U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's visit to NATO. He basically told European allies the U.S. has bigger priorities in Asia and Europe needs to take care of itself. That was followed by the Munich Security Conference this weekend, where Vice President J.D. Vance gave a scathing criticism of European democracy, a speech one European leader called, quote, fascist and anti-European. Vance also met with a far-right opposition leader in Germany while refusing to meet with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Then there were the comments of U.S. advisor to Ukraine and Russia, General Keith Kellogg, who told the Europeans, we'll take your interests into account, but you won't be at the negotiating table to end the war.
Now, what about President Trump? How was his call with Russian President Vladimir Putin received there?
Well, that was the cherry on the cake, eh? President Trump gave no heads up to European allies or Ukraine before holding, by all accounts, what was a friendly hour-and-a-half phone call with Putin, who Europeans consider an aggressor and pariah. Trump even went so far as to speak of lifting sanctions and bringing Russia back into the fold of nations. Leaders left Munich yesterday morose and stunned, Elie Tenenbaum told me. He's a security expert at the French Institute for International Relations. Let's listen.
So this has been their sort of nightmare scenario, that they were going to be bypassed by the United States to negotiate a peace deal over their heads.
And he says without its European allies by its side, the U.S. might try to strong arm Ukraine into a bad deal.
All right. Now, big meeting today in Paris. Who's going to be there? What's on the agenda?
Well, the leaders of eight nations are meeting. It's streamlined so they can move quickly. France, Britain, Poland, Italy, Germany, Spain, the Netherlands, and Denmark, plus two top EU officials and the head of NATO. On the agenda is increasing military spending, which might mean discarding long-established EU limits on budget deficits and authorizing massive spending. They will speak of how to guarantee any peace. In an editorial in a British newspaper yesterday, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said Britain would be ready to send troops to ensure a peace deal. This morning, Sweden said it too could send troops, and France has also said it would send troops, but it will take more than a couple nations to guarantee a peace, Tenenbaum told me.
What about Ukraine? What have they said about this?
Well, President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke forcefully at the Munich conference as soon as he saw what was happening. He says Europe must be at the negotiating table, and he's pushing Europeans to join with battle-hardened Ukraine to build a European fighting force. Let's listen.
We must build the armed forces of Europe so that Europe's future depends only on Europeans, and decisions about Europe are made in Europe.
He got applause for that, eh? Yeah. French officials described today's meeting as informal, and there'll be no final communique. They're trying to tamp down expectations for what is actually a very crucial meeting.
That's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's President's Day, so we wanted to look at how the current president, President Trump, is exercising the authority of the Oval Office and how that squares with the U.S. Constitution. To do this, we've got Jeffrey Rosen on the line. He's a professor at the George Washington University Law School and president of the nonpartisan, nonprofit National Constitution Center. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Good morning. Happy President's Day.
Happy President's Day. Okay. So over the weekend, President Trump posted this on social media. He said, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." What was your reaction when you read that?
Well, that is something that President Nixon asserted when he said, if the president does it, it's not illegal. But it's not a principle of the American Constitution, which is based on the idea that the president is not a king and that he is accountable to the Constitution and the laws.
So how far is Trump pushing the limits of his executive authority under the Constitution, which limits presidential powers with checks and balances from other branches of government?
Well, the definition of a constitutional crisis is very high. Mm-hmm. It's when the president openly defies an unambiguous Supreme Court ruling. And no president in American history has done that, and President Trump hasn't done that either. So in that sense, we are not yet in a constitutional crisis.
Now, that's something the Democrats have asserted. In your view, it's not there yet. We saw, though, a slew of resignations at Trump's Justice Department, including from conservative prosecutors, in protest of the decision to drop charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams, saying it was an illegal political trade. Does the White House have the ultimate word over whether cases are prosecuted by federal prosecutors?
Yes, prosecution is a core power of the president under Article 2 of the Constitution. So although the order to drop a prosecution for political reasons violates longstanding Department of Justice norms, it doesn't violate the Constitution.
Are there historical precedents for this use of executive power in this way that we're seeing from the current president?
That's the crucial question. And the truth is that executive power has vastly expanded ever since the beginning of the 20th century. Democratic and Republican presidents have tried to do by executive order what they couldn't achieve through Congress. And what we're testing now is the limits of that idea. There are a series of really important constitutional tests of executive power, including the president's ability to fire officers in independent agencies and his power to withhold funds that Congress has allocated. And those are two big categories of cases. It may go up to the Supreme Court. But the truth is, in both of those areas, the law is unsettled, and it's possible that the Supreme Court could overturn its previous holdings, which say that the Congress can create independent agencies and the president cannot withhold congressional funds. And in that sense, it's possible that they might approve of what President Trump is doing. But there's no question that under current law, he's testing the limits of executive power and attempting to do, you asked for historical precedents, what probably no president since Andrew Jackson, who President Trump embraces as a model and was attacked by his critics as King Andrew because he tried to centralize executive power in a populist way. And not since Andrew Jackson threatened not to spend funds in the Bank of the United States and also threatened, although didn't actually carry out his threat, to defy the Supreme Court, have we seen such a dramatic clash between presidential and judicial power.
Now, one of the things that the president has done is he wants to cut federal spending. And how he's doing is this, as he's reducing the workforce and saying he wants to eliminate certain federal agencies. What are the limits to the power the president can exercise over federal agencies?
Well, right now, Congress has created a series of agencies like the Federal Trade Commission that have quasi-independent officers, and the president can't fire them because he disagrees with them politically. They can only be fired for cause. In other words, if they do a bad job or some kind of wrongdoing. And the big question now is whether those limits on the president's power to fire are constitutional. And in fact, just yesterday, the Supreme Court received a petition to review a case where the president had fired an independent officer and he charged that as illegal.
Jeffrey Rosen is president of the National Constitution Center. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thousands of artists are asking a major auction house to cancel a sale of AI art. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Christie's is not budging.
Big auction houses have dabbled with AI art in the past. In 2018, Christie's sold a blurry painting of a male figure made with generative artificial intelligence that was trained on thousands of historic portraits for more than $400,000. And last year, a painting created by an AI robot artist named Ada went for more than $1 million at Sotheby's. Here's Ada describing what her work represents on YouTube.
In a post-human world, our algorithms make many of the decisions.
But Christie's upcoming sale may be the first time a major auction house is focusing entirely on works created using machine learning. And that's upsetting to many artists, such as Carla Ortiz. She's a plaintiff in an ongoing class action copyright infringement lawsuit against several image-based AI companies.
Christie's just doesn't care about artists. They just want to make money.
Ortiz was one of the first people to sign an online letter asking Christie's to cancel the sale, alleging that many of the auction's 34 artworks were created using AI models that could have been trained on unlicensed, copyrighted work.
Christie's is an institution. It's a household name. And for them to be holding this show basically normalizes what I consider theft.
AI is learning everything it possibly can from an entire set of data and images to then create something new. That's influence, not theft.
Nicole Sales-Giles is the director of digital art at Christie's. She says copyright issues arising from how the commercial AI models were trained are beyond the auction house's purview. And the demand for AI art is growing. Analysts predict it will be worth nearly $1 billion in 2028. Giles says Christie's has no intention of cancelling the upcoming sale, but she welcomes the voices of dissent.
We are excited that a sale is sparking such passionate conversation around art. This is what art should be doing.
The letter has inspired more artists to comment on the fraught relationship between art and commerce. The digital artist Beeple posted an artwork in response on social media titled The War of Art. It depicts a giant, shiny robot aggressively correcting the letter with red ink as he holds a leash attached at the other end to a tiny human. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we devote President's Day to understanding the scope of President Donald Trump's power as he continues to potentially break laws, use billionaire Elon Musk to dismantle the government, and circumvent Congress. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at cunard.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Arts and culture leaders are still trying to digest President Trump's surprise move to dismiss the leadership and board of Washington, D.C.'s premier performing arts center, the Kennedy Center, and have his hand-picked board install him as chairman. Trump said he wanted to make sure the center's offerings are less, quote, woke. While some of those connected to the center reacted mildly, others, like opera singer Renee Fleming, producer Shonda Rhimes, and actor Issa Rae, chose to cut ties or cancel scheduled shows. Still others were or are caught in the middle, like the Emmy Award-winning comedian and activist W. Kamau Bell.
Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama were the ones who pushed Biden out. She went to his house and told him, look, Joe, we've been trying to do this the easy way, but you're going to make us do this the hard way. Nancy Pelosi's the hard way? Nancy's from Baltimore. She watches The Wire to reminisce.
Bell says he was on a plane headed to perform at the Kennedy Center when he found out about the leadership purge. He did go on to perform his set the opening night of a 10-city tour, so we asked him to drop by our studios in Washington, D.C. to get his thoughts about the whole situation. He's here now. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me again how you heard about what happened at the Kennedy Center. Were you, like, literally on the plane? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, Trump had already said that he was going to take over, and so, but nobody knew what that meant. And so on the flight, I started getting, like, emails and texts, and it was just, like, a clear sense of, like, uh-oh, something's happened, you know.
Had you performed at the Kennedy Center before? And if you hadn't, either way, why did you want to?
No, I did a show there years ago in one of the smaller rooms, so I have a lot of respect for the Kennedy Center, and you can't help but feel, like, how cool it is to be there, even as an audience member, you know?
But, like, why, though? There are a lot of venues in Washington. Is there something about the Kennedy Center that feels special?
But there's something about that you sort of feel like a bona fide when you're at the Kennedy Center. There's something about, like, you have, nobody can tell me I'm not an artist of note ever again, you know? So there's just certain things you hit in your career when it feels like I always have that, you know?
So you and the comedian who opened for you, Dwayne Kennedy, made jokes about the whole situation. He said something like, welcome to the last time two black guys are going to be at the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
And you said something along the lines of, my kids like to eat every day,
yeah,
so that's why I'm here. But seriously, though, like, what were your thoughts about it? Did you ever consider canceling or
no,
not going on?
I mean, so the people from the Kennedy Center reached out because they were sort of like, almost like preparing for me to cancel. And I was like, I'm not, they're like, how are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Are you okay? Like, I was very clear that, like, this show was booked before we even, I think Joe Biden was still running for president when this show was booked. But for me, like, I'm connected to, as a black person, to all this history in my family of showing up. So, like, I knew there was never a point at which I thought about not showing up. And also, let's remember,
yeah,
the Kennedy Center's in a city called Washington, D.C. So as much as MAGA runs the White House, maybe, they don't run Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. has always been a bright, blue, progressive place. If you want to move the White House to Branson, Missouri, it would understandably you would program the Kennedy Center in a different way.
Well, what did you think he meant when he said he wanted the offerings to be less woke?
I think that woke is a catch-all for any idea, any culture, any art, any opinion that they don't agree with, which means it can mean anything at any time. But I think the funny part, I was talking to people at the Kennedy Center, and they said they've been reached out to about what the new program is going to be, and you're going to have empty houses at the Kennedy Center, because again, it is in Washington, D.C.
Did you change your set because of what
yeah,
has just occurred?
Yeah.
What was that like?
I really wanted to make sure at the top that I was, like, very clear and pointed about what the evening was. So I felt like I have to do this so everybody understands I know what's at stake here and which side I'm on. So.
Well, say more about that. Say more about the decision to go or not to go, because there are people who know your work know that you are a comedian, you know, in air quotes, but you're a social commentator. You are an activist. You make it very clear what your politics are. So just tell me about what the thought process is in deciding how to engage with the moment.
If the Kennedy Center had called me this week and said, do you want to do a show at the Kennedy Center? That would have been maybe a different decision. I might have still done it, but it's a different decision. But I'm like, I've been planning this for months, you know what I mean? And not just like, so part of it's like, I want to perform there because I want to do it for myself. Being a comedian is a very selfish art form. And so on some level, it's like, I, the performer, want to do the thing that I've been looking forward to. And then there's a part of me that knows my audience specifically in times of stress and pain and controversy actually wants to hear from me. Because, like I said, there's many different ways. Martin Luther King Jr. would talk to, like, Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. Like, we need the artists. He famously told Nichelle Nichols from Star Trek, who played Lieutenant Uhura, don't leave the show because you are important in your representation. So there's different ways to do this. And some of it is about showing up and being my full self, as my mom taught me, as the Bay Area raised me to be, as I want my kids to see me being in that space at that time.
Is there any part of you that worries that you're validating things you don't agree with by being in that space?
Not if I am my black ass self, and I don't mean to swear, but like I'm just like
you do mean to swear.
But I was like, if I can be myself in these spaces, then I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And so yeah.
Before we let you go, obviously there are a lot of people thinking about what is their role in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say your work is right now, and what would you advise other people to do who are sort of struggling with how they should show up or where they should show up or what they should be doing?
So I feel like I've been in, like, my whole career, at least for the last 15 years or so, has been about earning a living, but also making sure it's easier for the person behind me who either looks like me or is aligned with me. For me, it's like, oh, I understand. I wore a sweatshirt last night from Mahogany Mommies that says, dear ancestors, I understand the assignment. And so for me, it's like, I get it. I'm supposed to use the privilege I have to be loud and to be as clear as possible for the people who can't be loud and clear. And I got to take care of my family. But that does mean that sometimes, and I have done this for years, turn down things that were going to pay me because I can't be over there, because I don't think over there I can be my black ass self. So you got to do something. People say, stay in your lane. And we go, no, no, know your lane. What can you do in the lane that you're already in that can help make it easier on somebody who can't do the work that you can do? So whatever your job is, what can you do at your job? That's where it starts. Too many people are like, I'm going to go back to law school. No, no, no. What are you doing now? I'm going to start a nonprofit. No, no, no. What are you doing now? And how can you start making that lane more equitable, more inclusive, more diverse where you are?
That is the Emmy Award-winning comedian and producer and author, W. Kamau Bell. We caught up with him on the beginning of his 10-city tour. It's titled, Who's With Me? Kamau, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
This is NPR News.
Some New Yorkers are angry that Mayor Eric Adams has agreed to work with the Trump administration to crack down on illegal immigration.
The people who pay taxes in his city, the people who are up at 4 a.m. driving deliveries, those are the people who are being served up on a silver platter for President Trump.
I'm Elsa Chang. Is New York still a city that embraces immigrants? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. This month marks 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. NPR's Tamara Keith says Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Saudi Arabia this week for talks about ending the war.
We're expecting that meeting in Saudi Arabia with Russian officials and U.S. diplomats to discuss the end of the war in Ukraine At this point, Europe isn't at the table, and it's not clear just yet what Ukraine's role will be.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders, including NATO's Secretary General, have said Ukraine must be a part of the negotiations. President Trump spoke by phone last week with Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin separately. Kentucky is under a federal disaster declaration after weekend flooding left widespread damage and at least 9 people dead. Justin Hicks with Kentucky Public Radio says hundreds of water rescues have taken place.
Western Kentucky got the most rain. It's relatively flat. It got about 7 inches of rain in just about a day, which is a ton. It does seem like the most lasting damage, though, is going to be in eastern Kentucky, the more mountainous region.
The weather is blamed for at least one death in Georgia, where a tree fell on a house in Atlanta. Thousands of people lost power in areas of the South, including Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, Georgia, and Alabama. This is NPR News. The National Weather Service is warning of life-threatening cold from Kansas to Wisconsin to Montana. Temperatures are well below zero this morning in many areas of the central U.S. It's currently 23 degrees below zero in Bismarck, North Dakota. It's minus 11 in St. Paul, Minnesota. Extreme cold warnings are in effect in about a half dozen states. State police and a local prosecutor in upstate New York say the torture and murder of a 24-year-old transgender man does not appear to have been a hate crime. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
Sam Nordquist's body was found last week, and investigators say there's evidence the transgender man was the victim of ongoing physical abuse for more than a month before his murder. 5 people have been arrested, but in a statement, the Ontario County Prosecutor and state police said Nordquist's killing does not appear to be a hate crime. According to a statement, at least some of those accused of the murder also, quote, identified as LGBTQ+, and one of the alleged attackers lived with Nordquist. We understand the fear circulating in the LGBTQ+ community, the statement says. New York Governor Kathy Hochul, meanwhile, says another state agency focused on human rights will aid the ongoing investigation. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
About 4,300 workers at an Amazon warehouse in a suburb of Raleigh, North Carolina, have voted against unionizing. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faldin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The M23 rebel group has captured another large city in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's not clear where the Rwandan-backed rebels will stop, nor if there is anyone to stop them, raising the possibility of a regional war in Central Africa. Emmett Livingstone reports from the DRC capital, Kinshasa, and you should know you will be hearing gunfire.
It happened without a fight. In footage shot and posted on social media by a resident of Bukavu, columns of M23 fighters can be seen marching single file through the city over the weekend. In some neighborhoods of the 1 million person city, residents greeted the M23 with cheers. Congo's army withdrew without a fight. With no more control, residents began looting. Shelley Thakral with the World Food Programme said its warehouses of food, medicine and other supplies were ransacked.
The vital supplies stored were intended to provide life-saving support to the most vulnerable families in the DRC, who now face a growing humanitarian crisis.
Eastern Congo is a stunningly beautiful region with a violent history. It's also poor, despite being rich in vital minerals such as gold and coltan. This is the second major city in eastern Congo that the rebels have captured in recent weeks. In late January, the M23 and Rwandan troops violently captured the region's largest city, Goma, killing hundreds, if not thousands. Troops from four African countries besides Congo had defended Goma, but they were resoundingly defeated, increasing regional tensions. The US and other countries have called for a ceasefire, but the M23 and Rwandan troops continue to advance. In Bukavu, some M23 leaders stopped to talk to people on the street in footage shot by residents posted on social media. The group says it's fighting to protect minority communities and to end corruption. It wants direct talks with Congolese leaders, but the government refuses. Over the weekend, Justice Minister Constant Mutamba called for divine intervention.
L'armée la plus forte est la armée céleste.
The most powerful army is the heavenly army, he told the congregation. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced in just the past few weeks. Congo's government is doubling down on calls for sanctions on Rwanda. These haven't been forthcoming. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
In past years, houses of worship across the United States have provided sanctuary to immigrants at risk of deportation. Now, the idea is that inside a church, someone is safer from federal immigration enforcement. But what is it really like to live in sanctuary? And how does a church decide to take someone in? Colorado Public Radio's Haley Sanchez joins us now to explain. So, Haley, we've heard the term sanctuary used a lot in recent years, but what does it actually mean in this context?
Sanctuary is this act of faith communities offering protection to individuals at risk of deportation, and it has deep historical roots. Gina Perez is a professor at Oberlin College in Ohio, and she wrote the book Sanctuary People, Faith-Based Organizing in Latino Communities. She told me this practice dates back to ancient times when people sought refuge in religious spaces to escape state power. Now, in modern times, sanctuary isn't just about physically living inside of a church. It's this broader movement of legal aid, advocacy, and community support. And when somebody does enter physical sanctuary, this is a drastic step, usually seen as a last resort.
Okay, now let's talk about Jeanette Vizguerra, who sought sanctuary three different times in Denver. What was sanctuary like?
Jeanette says it wasn't just about staying hidden. It was about continuing to fight.
In this moment, the church is my home. But I continue organizing, not only local and national level.
This kind of activism from inside sanctuary is why Vizguerra became such a public figure in this movement. Vizguerra also got emotional and cried a little when she reflected on her time inside the church, saying sanctuary was both a lifeline but a sacrifice. And she missed out on time with her kids. She told me she had to prepare mentally for this reality that she could be confined for weeks, months, maybe even years.
I mean, where did she sleep and how did she get groceries or even like take her kids to school?
Yeah, so the church gave her a room. It's not like she was sleeping in church pews or a cot. And the third time she went into sanctuary, she actually brought her own furniture, even her own bed.
Oh, wow.
So she said she relied on friends and volunteers. They would pick her groceries up, her medicines. One time she told me about a time that she posted on Facebook tacos, and a friend called her and brought her some straight to the church. Technology was one thing that was instrumental to her.
Sometimes call my kids. That you remember tomorrow, need wake up for the school, what happened in your day and everything. My phone is my ally for watch my kids.
She says her four kids lived outside of the church and they would come to visit her inside the church on the weekends. The other thing Vizguerra had to keep in mind was she had to have a plan A, a plan B, and even C just in case something didn't work out. There were a few times when she had to leave the church and she laughed a bit when she said she had sort of an entourage to ensure her safety.
Sometimes almost a person around me is funny as the, oh my God, I'm similar one artist or one political person, have very much words around me.
Yeah, definitely sounds like an entourage. But Haley, churches. So what makes churches such a central place for sanctuary in the United States?
So churches have historically been seen as these sensitive locations, places ICE agents have been reluctant to enter despite there being no law forbidding it. And that's where this faith-driven justice kind of gets its power from, this authority of God and people's belief in that. Many religious communities also believe in welcoming the stranger, so for them, offering sanctuary is this moral obligation. It's just not that simple, though, as just opening up their doors. But as the professor, she told me that before a church can take someone in, it's a long process. Congregations discuss whether they have the resources and commitment to follow through.
That church, that congregation, goes through a discernment process where members of the congregation would have conversations about what is their ethical and religious obligations. You know, what do they feel equipped to do, right? Because there are certain things that you have to set in place and put in place in order to be able to have someone live in your church facilities for long periods of time.
So sanctuary isn't just about one person seeking refuge, and the responsibility doesn't just fall on one pastor, one specific faith leader. It's about the whole church community stepping up to provide food, legal aid, and emotional support to someone. And it's a huge responsibility, which is why many churches think really carefully before making that commitment.
Yeah. What's the reality of sanctuary today? I mean, is it still a viable option?
It's complicated. I mean, there isn't much data that tracks this, but anecdotally, under Trump's first administration, the sanctuary movement expanded, and now it appears ICE has been given the authority to be more aggressive, ignoring past policies that made churches off limits. The sanctuary movement hasn't disappeared entirely, but the reality is the sanctuary has never been a long-term solution. And for people like Vizgeta, it was the only option they had to stay with their families.
That's Colorado Public Radio's Haley Sanchez. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
We hear from a family in a historically black neighborhood of Altadena. The family lost everything in last month's LA fires. Next time in Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, me Martinez. Not quite from the Book of Jonah, but earlier this month off the coast of Chile, a humpback whale swallowed a kayaker. Adrian Hyman fell to blow to his back, which knocked him out of his kayak and into the whale's mouth. It was just for a few seconds as the whale spat him back out. His dad filmed the whole thing. Now, Adrian is okay and wants to get back out there once it's warmer. Or just a suggestion, how about when the waters are maybe a little more whale-free? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. This year, the NBA adopted a new format for its All-Star Game. Instead of one game full of superstars from across the league, a four-team mini-tournament took place last night at the Chase Center in San Francisco. In the end, Team OG, coached by Shaquille O'Neal, came out on top with a 41-25 victory over the Global Stars, coached by Charles Barkley. Did it succeed in drawing new viewers and new excitement? Martenzi Johnson of ESPN's Anscape is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So let's talk about the changes, Martenzi. Can you break down exactly what changed?
Yeah, like you said, originally it would be East versus West, right? Mm-hmm. 12 Eastern Conference All-Stars versus 12 Western Conference All-Stars. They fiddled with that over the years, switching it to captains who got to draft their own teams. But then we got to this year where they changed once again, where you said, again, it was the four mini tournament games to have a champion in the end. So the teams were broken up into eight players apiece of the 24 All-Stars, and then the fourth team was comprised of what they call rising stars, so that's the top first or second year players. So the format, it was neat, it was new, it was interesting, but I don't think
it worked.
I don't think so.
Okay, so what didn't work about it? I mean, was it not this big television spectacle? I mean, you would think maybe it displayed the players' talents a little bit more.
Yeah, so the problem has always been defense, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we know that these players can score, but it's just a matter of, do they care enough to play defense? Like, a couple years ago, the total score got up to over almost 400 points, so they had to do something. So if their defensive effort was zero leading up to this year, I give it about 50% this year. They still weren't playing all that much defense. There was still a lot of layups. There was still a lot of walking up the court. But it was some intrigue because one of the teams had to go against the first and second year players, and if you're an All-Star, you can't lose to the rookies, essentially, right? So they gave some effort there, but in that final game, again, it was a double point win in the score that only went up to 40 points.
Did any moment or player stand out to you?
No. What stood out was Kevin Hart, Mr. Beast, all the side stuff that didn't really have to do with the game that made it, you know, something that started at 8 o'clock that didn't end to almost midnight because it had all the extra stuff.
What are you hearing from fans and from players about the new approach?
Well, specifically players. Trae Young said he didn't like it. He didn't like all the stoppages in play. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander said, you know, right when we're getting to the groove of things, then we have to stop, right? At one point, there was a 20-minute gap in the middle of one of the games because they wanted to honor the Inside the NBA crew, who this is their last season doing NBA broadcast for TNT. So, yeah, it was just a lot of stoppage, a lot of Kevin Hart, a lot of commercials. So right when you're getting into the flow of things, you know, there's a stoppage again.
So are you saying the NBA should go back to the way it was?
Not necessarily. Like I said, it did actually build a little bit of intrigue this year, but they have to get all the extra stuff out. Like, I get you have to fill up, you know, 2-3 hour time blocks, but this wasn't it.
Martenzi Johnson of ESPN's Anscape, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
how insecurity can worsen inequality.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
For Marketplace, I'm Nova Safo and for David Brancaccio. A key theme in American life right now is uncertainty, whether that has to do with the rising cost of living, the flurry of actions by the Trump administration, or even costly natural disasters. All of this adds up to uncertainty, and it has Americans on edge. In fact, the latest University of Michigan survey of consumers finds sentiment down significantly across ideological lines. And Alyssa Quart, executive director at the nonprofit Economic Hardship Reporting Project, says pervasive uncertainty can pave the way for deeper inequality. She has a new piece in Time magazine titled How Insecurity Became the New Inequality. She spoke with David Brancaccio.
People in, for instance, North Carolina or California out searching for rentals because their house was destroyed in a disaster, they don't feel less secure. They are, in terrible ways, actually less secure. When policies change with this new presidential administration, some may feel more secure, others less. But you, Alyssa, you think insecurity like this leads to inequality, widening the gap between rich and poor.
It's not just a gap between haves and have-nots, but it's those who can't absorb the blows of things like the LA fires or the mudslides in Kentucky and so on and so forth, and middle-class people who can't keep up with inflation or the tariffs that will rise our prices. So this is insecurity as much as it is inequality, and they're inextricably linked.
Now, I mean, I think there's a lot of logic in this. Insecurity can be seen as like a reverse indicator for well-being, right? You can track insecurity, and when it goes up, it's not something that you want or that society wants.
Right. Insecurity has become an indicator that scholars now assess societal well-being. There's the Economic Policy Uncertainty Index. They talk about uncertainty shocks that create economic disorders. So the example they used was Brexit. So this preceded our current period.
When the lowest income people feel insecurity, it is a terrible thing. But part of the point that you're trying to make is that this, I mean, I never liked the word precarity, but this insecurity is being felt not just among the lowest income people.
Yeah, it was an abrupt precarity in relation to the pandemic for a lot of the poorer Americans. Remember, we had the American Rescue Plan, expanded child tax credit that reduced child poverty tremendously. Then you also had this growing middle class precarity, which I actually have been writing about since 2018. You know, I wrote a book called Squeezed, where I called it the middle precariat. That's middle class plus precarious plus proletariat. So I see this as kind of a form potentially of solidarity between people who are upper middle class, and lower income, this insecurity. And it's something that was mentioned by Astra Taylor in a great book called Age of Insecurity, where she saw that not just as a bane, but a potential way forward if we could start thinking of ourselves in those terms.
Alyssa Quart, executive director at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She has a piece in Time magazine entitled How Insecurity Became the New Inequality. Alyssa, thank you.
Oh, thank you, David.
And that was David Brancaccio with that interview. Numbers, Wall Street is closed in observance of President's Day. So far this year, though, stocks are in positive territory with the major indexes up somewhere between 3 and 5%. A different story for the benchmark 10-year Treasury yield, which helps set consumer interest rates. It's back to where it was at the beginning of the year, hovering around 4.5%. This has been especially consequential for the real estate market, where mortgage rates are averaging between 6 and 7%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, offering a nationwide network of billboards and data solutions that help businesses build brand awareness and influence consumer behavior. Billboardsforbusiness.com. And by Bitwarden, digital fitness can be accessible for anyone in the new year with a password manager designed to secure logins across all accounts and devices. Bitwarden.com.
The last two presidents made it a priority to secure a sufficient supply of critical minerals, which come from the ground you walk on. But the Trump administration is considering a different source, the ocean floor. Deep sea mining remains controversial and has yet to be approved in either federal waters or international ones. But as Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman reports, the mining industry sees opportunity.
As president, Joe Biden pushed the U.S. to get its minerals from places other than China. But when it came to the bottom of the ocean,
the Biden administration was officially on the fence, but really not wanting to do anything with deep sea mining.
Oliver Gunasekera is CEO of Impossible Metals, which hopes to harvest potato-shaped hunks of metal from the Pacific. And he says the Trump administration views the Department of Interior
like a balance sheet and an opportunity to extract oil and gas and critical minerals. And they've been talking very much about the seabed.
The shift in policy is a welcome one for the fledgling industry, which aims to start mining the seafloor in the coming years.
For us, America first is good news.
Jared Barron is CEO of The Metals Company, which is also eyeing the Pacific.
As America became energy independent with the advent of shale, it can become mineral independent with this resource 1,000 miles southwest of San Diego.
But that could pose a risk to the health of the ocean, says Beth Orcutt, VP for Research at Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences. While mining companies have developed some ways to clean up after themselves on land, like reforestation or water treatment,
there's no evidence that you can do that in the deep sea, so the disruption may be permanent, at least on human life scales.
There are also financial concerns. Two of the main metals available on the ocean floor are nickel and cobalt. Those have been key parts of electric car batteries, says Victor Vescovo, CEO of Caledon Capital. But today?
There has been some major advancements in battery technology, the biggest being lithium iron phosphate.
Those materials now make up most EV batteries sold in China, the world's largest market. And Vescovo says you can't really find them on the ocean floor.
So deep sea mining is an extremely difficult solution to a battery metal problem that existed 10 years ago.
Still, the U.S. Geological Survey deems nickel, cobalt, and other potential seabed resources as critical to the economy and national security. And the mining industry sees the next 4 years as its chance to go to sea and get them. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
And I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Bongo, bongo, I don't want to leave the Congo. Oh, no, 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 no.
No, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongo, I'm so happy in the jungle. And I'll tell you, so you will know. Each morning, a missionary advertised with neon signs. He tells the native population that civilization is fine.
And three educated savages holler from a bamboo tree.
That civilization is the thing for me.